And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is State v. Sierra. Ms. Meyer, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Lisa Meyer and I represent the appellant Jonathan Sierra in this action. I would note for the court that I did not represent the appellant at trial. I was appointed prior to sentencing and for purposes of this appeal. There are many issues before this court in this case. However, the overarching issue in this case were that there were substantial violations of the appellant's due process rights. The appellant was denied due process when the district court ordered he could not present evidence at trial from 4 out of his 5 witnesses. He could not present exhibits, and he could not present his alibi defense. Appellant was also denied due process in that his trial counsel was ineffective. She failed to exercise the ordinary training and skill that is required of all criminal defense attorneys.
Is that a due process right, or does it stem from the constitutional right to counsel?
It is a constitutional right to counsel. You're correct.
Okay.
Appellant asserts that she was ineffective in numerous respects. I will not be able to cover all of those today. They are covered extensively in my brief. Appellant would note that there is direct evidence on the record in this case that we believe could be used by this court to reverse this case on direct appeal. In the event that this court decides that there is not, we would assert that we have sufficiently explained or set forth our reasons for ineffective assistance of counsel, and we would ask that those be preserved for post-conviction relief.
Your argument that your witnesses should not have been excluded was not framed as a due process argument, was it? It was just that the court erred in granting the motion in limine?
Right. However, he was denied his witnesses, and that is a constitutional.
But it's framed as an evidentiary challenge, correct?
That is correct. The court used under the motion in limine ruling, it was a discovery and a reciprocal discovery issue. Discovery is governed by statute and court rule. However, in this case, it's those statutes and court rules that were being used to violate the constitutional right. I did note the constitutional guarantee within the argument.
Below, did you raise the constitutional due process claim, or did counsel raise the constitutional due process claim below to the trial court?
She did not. However, I would assert that she failed to do many things at the lower court. I would also assert that the inability of him to call 4 out of his 5 witnesses would be plain error on the record such that it could be considered by this court.
There was a general discovery stipulation entered by the parties, correct?
It was, and general...
Without any limitations listed.
It has no specifications listed. It was discovery and reciprocal discovery.
So my question was there was no limitations in it. That's correct.
That is correct. However, under Nebraska Revised Statute 29-19-16, reciprocal discovery is like for like. Whatever the defense asks for should be given in return. And I would assert that the prosecution in serving discovery did not provide names of witnesses. That was not part of their discovery. That was given to the defense. Names of witnesses.
Part of the information that was filed, is that correct?
Yes, it was filed with the information, which was before even the discovery stipulation was entered.
Were police reports provided?
I believe police reports were provided.
Were the names of the witnesses contained therein?
Yes, which was part of...
Was any further requests made by the defendant to obtain further information about those witnesses from the state?
No. Additionally, I would assert under Nebraska Revised Statute 29-19-19, the sanctions for failure in discovery indicates that a witness not disclosed can be precluded from presenting evidence or being used as a witness. I asserted in my brief that that is singular. I have not challenged the constitutionality of the statute on its face. I am stating that application of it in this case violates defendant's constitutional rights because he was denied the ability to call 4 out of his 5 witnesses. I believe that the case cited by the state is a Virginia case. It's not controlling here. That case indicates it was interpretation of a person
Doesn't Nebraska have a rule of construction concerning singular and plural references under Nebraska Revised Statute 49802?
I'm not familiar with that, but apparently, yes, it does. I would argue, again, not familiar, but considering that this can be used to violate or take away an appellate's constitutional right to present witnesses, that it should be construed in the singular.
So if you fail to disclose 20 witnesses, the sanction is that one can be excluded and the other 19 get to testify?
Under the statute, there are other options that the court has. They could continue trial. And then finally, there's any other just reason, whatever that the court deems would be just under the circumstances. I would assert that in this situation, trial should have been continued. It was obviously a failure on the part of trial counsel, which I go through at length in the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. This is not a failure of the appellant, for the appellant to be subject to an inability to present his case because trial counsel simply didn't do their job and didn't prepare. That's a violation.
Essentially, you have two arguments going forward at the same time here. You have the ineffective assistance of counsel argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then you have the argument that the court made a mistake.
Yes.
And I think it's important that you try to keep those separated because they're different considerations for this court.
Yes. In regards to the alibi defense, this is specifically an ineffective assistance of counsel portion that I'm addressing at this point. She knew about the alibi defense. She indicated at the motion in limine hearing that she planned to present alibi evidence. The appellant told her of his alibi version early in the case. The trial counsel also indicated that she had received a report that included alibi witnesses that she had intended to use far in advance of the case, and she failed to file a notice of alibi. She was well aware of the statute. I believe on the record, this is absolutely something that this court can reverse this decision on in regards to the ineffective assistance of counsel. I would finally note that there was a 17th assignment of error that included a double jeopardy claim regarding the thefts. There were 3 thefts we assert were of the same course of conduct out of the same building at the same time. The state has conceded that claim and also indicates that 2 of those convictions should be vacated, and we would ask that the court enter this order as such. If there's no further questions of the court at this time, I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
This court has only, as far as I can recall, addressed ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal twice, and both times they were by divided courts. What are the specific, particular circumstances of your strongest claim for ineffective assistance of counsel that you claim we should reach on direct appeal, and why?
I believe that the neglection of the risk to file the witness list 10 days before, resulting in the exclusion of the witnesses and exhibits, is probably the strongest on the record. Second would be the lack of the notice of alibi is definitely apparent on the record.
She also failed to move to even continue at the motion in limine hearing. The writing was on the wall. If you read the transcript from the judge, he was very upset with her. And she didn't even move to continue. I think that's apparent on the record that it was an option before the court. It is a potential sanction under the rules. And so I believe that those are the main ones. And I believe I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. The case presents several issues. We have the ruling on the motion to withdraw counsel, the motion to limine by the state. We have the alleged plain error on two of the three theft convictions related to the tools and toolboxes, and then we have the ineffective assistance claims. In short, we see no error with the district court's pretrial rulings on the motions. As opposing counsel noted, we did concede that two of the three theft convictions should be vacated, as I understand the law, both here in Nebraska and generally. And then the ineffective claims, the record generally is insufficient to address them, although there are a few that we think are insufficiently alleged or firmly refuted by the record and may be disposed of on direct appeal. So we ask this court to affirm in large part and in part reverse and vacate.
Could you comment on the adequacy of addressing the failure to give the notice of the alibi in terms of ineffectiveness?
Well, I think obviously it would be deficient performance to not give notice of the alibi as required by the statute. Our position in brief was that, well, we can't determine prejudice, and so the record is insufficient on the to address the claim on direct appeal. Largely because we don't really know the specifics of the alibi evidence, the alleged witness, how it would be viewed in context, how it would relate to the other evidence presented, etc.
So the state's view is it's too hypothetical at this point on this record.
More or less, yes.
Was there an offer of proof?
I think all of that was stated. I don't know there was an official offer of proof, but it was essentially something about the mom owning the car, and the car that was used was a green Honda Accord. But again, I don't know how that relates or how much probative value that would have in relation to the rest of the evidence in the record. And so that's why I think the record is insufficient to address it. It should be left for post-conviction. But not providing a notice of alibi when you have alibi evidence and then getting that excluded, we don't dispute, would be deficient performance.
But you're saying that the context doesn't show prejudice. I beg your
pardon? No, go ahead.
Doesn't show the prejudice, if any.
Right.
Okay.
Is there a possibility that the defense attorney made a determination that the alibi was simply too ridiculous or too far-fetched to even make a notice?
That could be. Based on the record, it didn't seem that was the decision that she made. I suppose that could also be true as well, which would also, you know, suggest that it should be better left for post-conviction review. That's just preserved, the record insufficient here to address it. On the pretrial motions, I would emphasize, as Your Honors, I think, pointed out, that the constitutional arguments were not made below. It was really just a question of discretion with the motion to withdraw and then how the statutes worked with the discovery issue. I didn't see any abuse of discretion based on the record with regard to the motion to withdraw. The defendant basically said that he was upset with her communication, with how she was moving forward with the defense. Much of the things that were cited in the brief were not presented to the district court by the counsel. And so to me, it was not an abuse of discretion, basically that it was the defendant expressing dissatisfaction with his attorney, which is not sufficient under this court's case law. With the discovery, as Your Honor pointed out, I think it was a pretty broad order. It was stipulated that it was discovery and reciprocal discovery. I think since discovery is based on the statute, that would include everything under 1912. I think that's how the parties and the district court understood it based on the record. So there was a discovery violation, and then the 29-19-19 allows the exclusion of witnesses, which, as I said in my brief, a witness is not singular, and that would make no sense considering the very next subsection would be allowing the district court to basically enter any order for a just reason. And then the plain error, like I said, on the theft convictions, my understanding from this court's case, State v. Garza in 1992, was that a theft that occurs at the same time in the same place is one offense. So the stealing of the tools here, although they were from different owners, should have been one charge. So the three theft convictions for the theft of the toolboxes and tools should have been one. And my research based on the federal courts is that the remedy, since here the sentencing is concurrent in the same classification of felony, the remedy would be to vacate two of the three convictions and sentences. As far as the ineffective claims, unless this court has any further questions, I would stand on my brief on that, largely the record being insufficient to address them on direct appeal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day, then, is In Re Interest of Tayson D.